Hello and welcome to an Albion Raw special here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast, and in front of a live audience here at Brighton's fabulous Commedia Theatre.
You are live.
I'm AD Packham, and support for this show, as ever, comes from Phil Shelley's magnificent oldfootballshirts.com. Joining me, as ever, is my learned friend to my left, Mr. Alan Wares. And we are delighted to welcome two men who have played a massive part in getting the Albion to where they are now. Firstly, allow me to introduce a man who made his name as a player with Brentford and Sheffield United before answering Mickey Adams' call to become his assistant at Brighton. He went on to work under six, yes, that's six, who anyone's entered our competition this week, six different managers and gained three promotions. He also has a keen eye for the birds and once thought about a career as a car park attendant. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Bob Booker. Cheers, guys.
Good to see you all tonight. Thanks for coming out. Hopefully you're going to enjoy a few stories from the boys and just enjoy yourself. Okay. Not too much heckling.
And of course, alongside Bob, we're delighted to welcome a man who's has been around a bit. And he's had an illustrious career playing that saw him win the European Cup Winners' Cup under Alex Ferguson at Aberdeen and also took in Celtic, Newcastle and Hamburg along the way. He moved into management and has managed eight different clubs, including a spell at Brighton, where he won promotion via the playoffs in 2004. He's now assistant manager of Scotland, and it is unclear whether he still enjoys a pint of whiskey. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Mark McGee.
Can I just say, I've got a slightly different take on Bob being the assistant to six different assistants. In fact, Bob got six different managers the sack.
Can I just say, can we start the show off? I've just realised you're an assistant manager. Do you put Gordon's kit and boots out for him?
No.
Do you pick him up when he's drunk?
No.
Do you take him his papers in the morning?
No.
Never been an assistant.
I think you've got a tough job tonight, AD. I'm glad I'm sitting. Was that your script?
Bob! we have this beautiful book, which is available via City Books in the back. This is called Who Are Bob Booker? We're going to be talking about that probably quite a lot.
Hopefully.
but you've had a busy week plugging it. You've been in the Argus, on the BBC, and of course, on the Albion Raw.
Yeah, no, everyone's been absolutely fantastic and really pushing it and just building up to tonight's event, really. So, looking forward to that. So, yeah, City Books have done absolutely unbelievable for us. It's down there if you want to go down and buy it. I can sign one tonight. That'll put another 10p on it.
10p off.
10p off, yeah.
The really treasured ones are the unsigned ones.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll be talking it a little bit later down the line. But, yeah, hopefully it's going to be an interesting read and a nicely timed Christmas present. 109 days to Christmas. That's all I'm saying. You know how quick it comes round. $12.99. Come on.
I've never seen an author looking so smug here.
The paper's quite thin as well.
Can I just say, I don't know how well the book's going, but my author down there, Greville Waterman, and his good lady, Miriam, are staying in the Grand tonight. Now, either I'm missing something or there's a few sales going through that I'm not getting. I've got to get my good lady wife to drive me home, and he's staying in the Grand. Something's not quite right.
Well, at least you can still stand at the moment.
Right, so it's all back to Greville's afterwards.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to talk about that season of getting up, staying up, and why you should be scared of Dick Knight wants to take you for an Italian. So let's go back to a simpler time, a time when us spending £15 million on a player was preposterous. In fact, spending 15 quid would have been nearer the mark. And our heroes were in short supply. Well, they were short. Blundell Park then, 4th of May 2003, were relegated after a 2-2 draw. It was to be Bobby Zamora's last game for the club. Steve Coppell remained as manager for the 2003-04 season, and bringing in Leon Knight to replace Bobby Zamora. Coppell eventually left, leaving to join Reading, leaving one Bob Booker in temporary charge. Again. That went well, didn't it?
Again. I was left with all the muck and all the rubbish, wasn't I? Yeah, I was there, but just kept the ship going, hopefully. So, yeah, I was still there.
Well, it did involve a 4-0 defeat at your old club, Brentford.
Greville, calm down.
I thought you were going to bring it up. And that was difficult, so some of you fans might have been behind that goal to the right, and the dugouts were, unfortunately, right down near that end on the right-hand side. And that was a bad night for me. You know, if you're going to be in charge for one or two games, whatever it was going to be, then you really want to try and get a result. But as you say, we dipped miserably, and I remember throwing a tray of tea across the dressing room and really ripping into Chris McPhee. I don't know why I picked on him. He must have been the youngest, but I just made a beeline for him. He wasn't getting hold of the ball. He wasn't doing what centre-forwards do, and I lost the plot. And hopefully I didn't lose the rest of the group of players, but we failed miserably. And it was a bad, bad night going back to my old club. And his dad's a copper and all.
Okay, well, moving on. It was the 28th of October 2003, and we appointed some bloke called Mark McGee as our manager. And what attracted you to the job?
I think I was unemployed.
I mean, you'd only left Millwall 2 weeks previously.
I was still unemployed. Well, I mean, I think that I went up. I got a phone call asking if I'd be interested in discussing the opportunity at Brighton, and I went to a hotel in London and I met with Mr. Knight.
Could you get a word in edgewise?
Notice I was careful there about your list of banned words. I met with Mr. Knight up in the hotel, and, you know, his enthusiasm for everything about the club, including the difficulty that the club was in with regards to where they were playing and the hope that one day they would get a new stadium and all of that.
How long did he tell you it was going to be?
Well,
there was
no time put on it, because he was realistic in the sense that he knew there was a fight on, because he knew the planning and all of that was going to take a lot of investment and a lot of work. And to be fair, when I spoke to him, I thought, yeah, I could be part of that. I also kind of knew the squad a little bit, and when I looked at the squad and the start they had made, I felt that they were better than that, and that therefore, you know, I could go in and improve it fairly quickly. So, yeah, those two things combined persuaded me that, yeah, I should. Oh, three things: unemployment, Mr. Knight, and
working
and,
with
of course,
me.
Yeah, well, that came later, of course. Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, can we do a Phoenix from the Flames here? Because Bob, you do a reasonable Dick Knight impression. How did this meeting go? Come on, let's hear how this meeting would have gone.
I've got to say, I mean, Mark got invited up to London to a lovely hotel, and I got invited down to Topolino's, which later on in my career I named as Sacolino's. But Dick, you know, I was sitting there with Dick and you know, Mickey, you know, we've got great plans for the club. Bob, you're going to be into a new stadium in 2 years. It's going to be absolutely fantastic. Blows all smoke over me. He had about 10 fags in half hour. It was just, like, unbelievable. You know.
Did you get that treatment, Mark, first time?
No, I don't remember. To be honest, I don't even remember that Dick smoked. You know, I'm very, very fond of my time here with him. We worked well together. We certainly did make some progress with regards to the fight for the stadium. We both marched the streets along the seafront, and I did talks and tried to persuade people of the sense, which hopefully now everyone can see with what's happened and what it's become, that the futility of that fight to stop it was just ridiculous. Mm. So, you know, I was part of that and enjoyed that, you know. But no, initially it was as much to do with his enthusiasm that sold me the club.
I was about to say, stadium protesting isn't usually part of a manager's brief, is it?
No, but you know, it's what you have to do. You it was what was going on at the club at the time, and you know, I had been sold the idea that however long it was going to take, that I'd still be the manager. I have to say that. That didn't quite work out, but...
Well, you are a manager, just not of Brighton.
Yeah, well, no, I'm not. I'm assistant manager.
Have you asked Bob about that?
Although, to be fair, that's probably about right, what you said.
well, Mark, you were unveiled as manager at the Grand Hotel. Now, Bob, the Grand Hotel was something which you knew a little bit about because you were under... Whenever we were trying to sign a new player, you were to show with Dean or the training ground to the... no time whatsoever. Could they see the ground, the training ground, or the ground?
Well, that's the first time I'd seen a room like that in the ground. I mean, as you say, when we was trying to sign a player, especially in Mickey's here, not so much when Mark came, but first of all, and we didn't have any money, we didn't have any players, and we might have signed the odd player from a Premier League team, you know, a Steve Sidwell or something like that, and Mickey would say, get yourself down to the back line and meet the player, and... you know, sort him out. I said, OK, I'll bring him up to the training ground. No, don't bring him up there. Don't bring him up here. Well, what do you want me to do, Gaffer? I'll take him to Withdean. No. Don't take him to Withdean. Just don't show him the ground. Tell him he'll see the ground on Saturday. I said, what am I going to do then? He said, well, take him down to seafront, stroll him along the seafront, take him in the grand, get him an ice cream. Use your club credit card. It'll bounce, but use it. Take him in the grand, get him some coffee, let him see all the young ladies walking up and down the seafront, sell it to him, and then take him back to the hotel. And that's how we used to deal with players, and not too much dissimilar when we had to get players in with you, you know.
Yeah, but I think that's also true. I mean, I remember when it was the opposite. When I went to Reading as manager, you didn't take them to the ground. You took them to the training ground because we had a fantastic training ground, but Elm Park was probably the worst ground in the country at that time, you know, so you didn't let them anywhere near Elm Park if they hadn't been there already, and you'd take them to the training ground. So it was, you have to do these things.
You're not going to take them around the town centre in Reading, are you?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. You take them to Oxford and you tell them, yeah, it's Reading.
So Mark, Bob was foisted upon you as your assistant. What did you know about him beforehand?
Only as a player. You know, Bob had played in the same era as me. He was playing for Sheffield United when I was playing at Newcastle. I've really always been kind of open-minded about going to clubs on my own. I went to Millwall on my own and inherited the staff there. I've always think that's a good thing from the point of view of there's a couple of aspects to it. One is that it's very difficult to get jobs, and when people go in and they just sack the people that are there or they get rid of the people that are there, I think that's very unfair because there's a lot of good people lose their jobs unnecessarily.
Thank God for that.
Because, you know, a lot of people go into jobs and they have this fear of, you know, not trusting people or, you know, needing people that they think watching their back. And whereas I felt the opposite. I felt you go in, you see how people do, but you retain the kind of the autonomy with the chairman to say, well, you know, if they're not good and I don't think they're going to do the job justice or I can't work with them, then I have to be allowed to get rid of them. But mostly wherever I've been, I've found that the people that you inherit are good people. And that's what happened when I came to Brighton. I inherited a staff that were really different class and that backed me from the very, very start.
Okay, well, speaking of the staff, you also inherited the squad and you made quite an impression on your first training session. Did John Pearcey ever forgive you?
You know, it was just something I saw. I assume I'm thinking about the right thing, but it was a little bit of psychology that... I mean, I worked with, I think, the best sports psychologist I've ever, you know, in the game ever, and that's Alex Ferguson. You know, a great manager, but a fantastic psychologist, you know, getting the best out of people. And I arrived, and my first training session, what I saw was, you know, dissent and bickering and criticism and negativity, you know. So someone gave a bad pass, someone would tell them, you know, that it was a bad pass, or if someone had a shot, they shouldn't have a shot, they'll tell them. And the whole thing just for me was a little bit kind of, the atmosphere was wrong. So are we talking about the right thing here?
Yeah, keep going. Yeah.
So I saw that and I kind of employed a device that I kind of thought of at the time. And what I did was, without knowing any of the boys, I turned to the first one and I said to him...
This was John Pearcey.
Yeah, I said to him, you know, I don't know who you think you are, but I've not come here to work with people like you who are going to, you know, put that sort of limited effort and who are going to train as poorly as that. You know, and I saw his face just kind of drop, you know, like obviously as it would, the new manager's just slaughtered me. And then I think I turned to Dan Harding and I said to him, I said, you know, and I used him as an example, and I said, you know, that is how you train. That is what I want to see, you know, day in, day out. And you could see Dan Harding sort of, he couldn't control the smile on his face, you know, he was like, you know, sort of like, you know, grinning. You know, because the new manager's has praised them. So then I turned back to John. I said, how did that feel? And he said, rubbish. And I said, well, I didn't actually mean it. I didn't really believe, I didn't really see you training badly. But that is what I've seen. I've seen you all have that sort of effect on each other, that you have negativity, you feel bad, a bit of positivity, and you feel good. So from now on, we'll only accept positivity. So from that point on, really, I just asked them not to be negative about things, about mistakes, about whether, you know, whatever. Just, you know, accentuate the positive. And that's what, that was, I think, in the first morning.
At which Charlie Oto went, what?
Did you know much about the squad at the time?
No, I didn't know much about them. I mean, I had been at Millwall. We had been in the Championship. We'd left the First Division a year earlier, a year and a bit earlier. So I wasn't all that familiar with them. But, you know, as a football manager, you go in, and I think it doesn't take you long to make assessments. I remember in the first morning looking at the squad, and there was a lad, and I said to Bob, who's that? And he said, that's Adam Virgo. And I said, well, why was he not playing? And he said, well, he's been at loan at Exeter or something like that,
yeah,
you know.
That's correct, yeah.
And I said, he's your best player, you know. And that was like in the first day I was there. These things happen. I remember when I was at Millwall, football people see things. I remember I took, Glenn Johnson from West Ham on loan as a fullback. And he trained the first morning. And I remember Dennis Wise saying to me, who's that? And I said, he's a young lad from West Ham. And Dennis Wise said, this is after one training session. Dennis Wise said to me, he's England's next right back. You know? So football people do see things. And that morning, I saw Adam Virgo and I thought, I don't understand why he's not an important part of this team. So very quickly, I started to establish my feelings about who should be in the team and what they could contribute and make the changes I needed to make.
So what was it about Adam Virgo specifically that actually you zeroed in on it? You thought, yeah, this guy's pretty good.
Everything about him, his attitude towards training, his size, his athleticism, you know, his finishing. He had a whole range of abilities that in comparison to some of the others that I was looking at, you know, he looked better.
OK, well, the first game you in charge was against Peterborough. It was a 2-2 draw, two goals from Leon Knight. Do you remember the first team you picked?
I can't remember the last team I picked.
I will tell you,
it was one of them, wasn't it?
I could have a go.
Go on.
Capers.
Who would have picked it? Would it have been you or Bob?
Well, it would have been.
Yeah, I picked it because we drew in the next game. Together, you know,
I'd have taken Bob's advice and said.
I see what you did there.
No.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what it is because we've got lots to get through. It was Kuipers, Cullet, Watson, Butters, Nathan Jones, Kerry Mayo, Robbie Pethick, Richard Carpenter, Gary Hart, Leon Knight, Chris McPhee. On the bench was Ben Roberts, Adam Hinchinwood, Zess Raymond, Dan Harding and Sean Wilkinson.
I've got to say, with that team that you've just mentioned there, it's not surprising we went up. Yeah, well, is it?
I think it's not surprising that we improved because that's what I saw when I saw them at training. I looked at them and I thought, you know, these are better than they've been showing. And I think, you know, you've just described a team there that had quite a lot about it, you know, so yeah.
Well, you just said that you picked the team for the next game, which went really well. No, it didn't. But it was a bit of a recurring theme because we were playing against Bristol City at home. And Bristol City and you comes up quite a lot in your story with the Albion, doesn't it?
I started my career at Bristol City, you know, as a kid. I was at Bristol City as a youth team player for 2 years. I'm very fond of Bristol City. The most important game and the only game that I really remember about Bristol City was at Cardiff. So anything that helped happen to Bristol City is irrelevant. You know, we beat Bristol City and we were promoted. I don't know, were you there?
It was a 4-1 defeat. What was your reaction to that defeat? Can you remember?
The most important thing is that Bob and I had a good night out.
What did John Keighley say, Bob?
We did have a good night out, but Mark was taking me to the places that I'd never been before, you know. Bottles of polyfumate at £30 a time. It was, that wasn't in my locker, that was. It was like lager top and £2.50, that was me. But, we did have a good night, and I made it quite clear to the gaffer that we'd just been beaten in the manager's room, if you remember rightly.
Yep.
And he said, hey, big man, we're going out for a beer. I said, gaffer, no, you don't do that in Brighton. You know, we've just been beaten at home. You don't go out. He says, I'm telling you, we're going out for a beer. And if the manager tells you you're going out for a beer because he's the gaffer. So I don't think we was that bad. I thought we had a nice good night. I can't particularly.
By the way, I thought it was more than 4-1. Is it only 4-1? I tell people it was 5-0.
Anyway, so we had a fairly good night, and I remember Cumlin was in training the next morning because we got beaten 5-4. And we're sitting in the gaffer used to sit opposite here, and I sit here, and John Keighley, the kit man or the goalkeeping coach, because you doubled up in jobs then. I had 7 or 8 jobs. And John Keighley come in and said, all right then, gaffer. And I'm like, fine, Keighley, fine. He said, had a good night, did you? Oh, yeah, me and the big man, we had a couple of beers.
That's
know,
how down, I used to talk.
Till he moved down here. A few beers downtown, and John Keighley said, yeah, I heard you was like steaming a little bit, you and Bob, you was all over the place downtown. And his face changed, and he looked at John Keighley, went, hey, listen, you tell your mates, wait till we win a game, then you'll see us have a drink.
I mean, in all this time, I mean, obviously, Bob does an impersonation of you. Mark, can you do an impersonation of Bob?
Absolutely not. Oh.
Okay, well, you inherited the core of the double promotion winning team, so there was a lot of characters in that room, in that dressing room. Did you have to do much to change them? Or?
Yeah, I think I did. I mean, and I started that morning with the story we've already told, but I remember looking at it, and one of the other things I saw was there was a kind of randomness about the way they played. So, for instance, in very basic terms, if they got a throw-in in the right back area, then one time they would throw it down the line, and the next time they would throw it inside, and the next time they would drop off and they would throw it back and boot it up the line. It was kind of like haphazard, you know. So one of the things we did very early on was we stripped all that back and we gave them a little bit of ownership, and we went right through the whole card and said, right, okay, we've got a throw in here, we've got a throw in here, we've got a throw in there, we've got a free kick there, a free kick there. And we went through everything that could possibly happen. And we said, right, so what do you want to do? What are you trying to achieve from this position? You know, and we got them to say, well, from this position, we're trying to get the ball as far up the park as we can. Or we want to get the ball to the other side of the pitch, you know. So we talked it through and we agreed it. And we decided, right, so if we get the ball in this area, this is what we're going to do. And we brought consistency to, you know, so when they went out on a Saturday, they knew that in any certain area, this is what they would do. So it wasn't just haphazard. We brought a little bit more continuity to everything that they did, and I think they appreciated that. And on the back of that, they were able to there establish a better way of playing.
Okay. Well, Bob, we lost Bobby Zora in the summer, and we replaced
him... Sorry if that answer bored you there.
What? Bob, can you translate, please?
He said, sorry if he bored you.
But we lost Bobby Zamora in the summer, and he was replaced by Leon Knight. Now, you had to deal with him initially with Steve Coppell and then, of course, Mark, but he was a tricky character in the dressing room.
Yeah, he was tricky. I mean, he was a little git, to be honest with you. Yeah, listen, he was a likeable rogue, Leon. You know, you knew after the game that the police are going to be outside seeing what car he's in. But he was sort of lovable, and Mark sort of man-managed him really, really well, especially leading up to the Cardiff game. But, you know, Mark would send me off and do a session, and if it wasn't really involving Leon, he wasn't that interested, to be fair. He would sort of down tools, wouldn't he, and his shoulders would drop. And Mark was quite into sort of the physical side of stuff, and we used to run the players. And to be honest, he couldn't do it, Gaffer,
no,
could he?
That was his problem. I mean, Leon Knight had technically had great ability. he was very small, you know, which was a problem for them, because at the time, I used to fight for him all the time in terms of his protection for referees, because you get a centre-half and you can actually tackle someone like Leon Knight legally, but you can hurt them, you know, and there was a lot of that going on, you know. He was getting cleaned out week after week, and I always felt that he wasn't getting the protection from referees that he should have been getting. But Leon himself couldn't get himself fit enough to be the player that he should have been. You know, when he did pre-season training, he was tailed off. He'd run out of energy, he'd stop. When other people were still lapping and pushing themselves and getting fitter, Leon couldn't do that. He didn't have the mental capacity to push himself, to make himself do it. And therefore, he never, ever reached a level of fitness that allowed him to be the player that he really should have been. You know, because there's plenty of players his size have had better careers than him.
If he had the application, how far would he have gone?
I think, he wouldn't have left Chelsea. You know, he'd have been at Chelsea. He was a fantastic finisher. He could easily have played at another division higher than eventually he played at, if he had had the desire to get as fit as he should have got.
Well, I was just saying that some of the times when if the gaff was putting a session on and you could see that his shoulders had dropped, he wasn't interested because it wasn't about him. So you stop the session and talk to Leon. Come on, you know, it's a team game. No, I don't want to do it, Bob. I don't want to do it, Gaffer. You know, go in then. We used to send him in, didn't we? We'd send him in and come up to the office in the afternoon and sit him down and, come on, what's it about, little man? You know, well, you know, I'm a finisher. I said, well, I'll talk to you. Then I'll come in tomorrow morning before training. We'll get a bag of balls, 20 balls, get one of the young goalkeepers, and we'll go out there before training and do a one-on-one, you know, for half an hour. What, you do that for me? Well, yeah. So you play the game with him a little bit and manage him. And He would come in and do that, but in a team aspect, he wasn't that keen. But I think you played the master stroke at Cardiff when you threatened to drop him. When you know it's
what, out the window.
We'll come on to Cardiff in a minute, but first, you are listening to The Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on a podcast, and live here at the Comedia Theatre in front of all of these beautiful people. We are, of course, brought to you in association with oldfootballshirts.com, and we're delighted to welcome to the stage our sponsor, Mr. Phil Shelley from oldfootballshirts.com.
Yes. Good evening. We normally do this on the radio with nobody watching. First of all, I'm going to unveil the shirt of the
unveil
week.
Unveil the shirt for me, Phil.
That's what I wasn't looking forward to. Okay.
I think it's Idi Amin's.
Who knows the team?
We've got Germany,
Well,
Ghana.
Let's have a description, chaps.
We're on the radio, aren't we? It looks a bit like a Belgium shirt, but I know different. It's white with some kind of bird swimming, going across it, with what looks like the Belgium flag going vertically down the shoulder. And it's made by Hummel. It's got a football on the badge. And is that cranes on it?
It is cranes.
Oh, it's not three male geese. To represent the country
I'm
that it is.
I'm breathing in, and I've got to breathe in a lot more for the shirt in the second half.
Right, remove your hand from
it. What do you reckon, Yo? Do you like it?
Even on Phil.
Uganda.
It is a Uganda shirt. Who's going to read this out then?
Here we go then. This is a stunning shirt made by Hummel. It's a 2001 to 2002 Uganda home shirt. The team are known as the Cranes, after the national bird of the country, as you can see, displayed prominently on the shirt. Their best ever showing in the African Cup of Nations was in 1978, when they finished as runners-up to host Ghana. They play their home games at the 45,202 capacity Nambuli Stadium, which is in Bayweregeri, in the Kira municipality, which is the second largest city in Uganda. They are currently ranked 73rd by FIFA, just three places below Israel. So, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Phil Shelley! Now, while we're talking about shirts, what happened to the shirt in 2004-05? It was the wrong colour, wasn't it? It was the wrong colour blue.
The Argentina shirt.
Actually,
who chose the Argentina shirt? Is anyone going to claim?
Dick picked all the kit colours. Blame it on him.
It's colourblind as Phil.
Was it through all that smoke?
He just liked detail, down to even like the cords of the shorts, because small is good. That was Dick. But, you know, he got involved in everything. As Mark said, he was so enthusiastic in the kit, you know. That's why it was always late. Burnley, it turned up. But remember, Steve Coppell, Burnley turned up just before the game, the kit.
All right.
Well, it wasn't Kitman was on the phone. It's landed. It's taken off again. It's landed.
But he was the one that actually took credit for David Yeldell wearing a pink shirt at Leeds. Does that ring true?
Ooh, good luck.
Do you not remember this?
I remember it, but I think, did you not?
We got a 0-0, I think, didn't we?
I think no,
the story I heard was clashed with the referee's shirt.
Yeah.
The story I heard was that when they were choosing the goalkeeper shirt, Michel Kuiper wanted one of absolutely everything.
Right.
And that included the pink one. And, it was a clash with the goalkeeper shirt.
I'm not going to argue with Michel Kuiper's wearing a pink shirt.
And he got absolute pelters from the Leeds fans before wearing this shirt.
But he actually then also got a massive round of applause for playing really well at the end of the game. Those that were there, I'm sure there's a few that were here, were there. I mean, I think it was a stunning save from, was it Ian Hart, I think it was, or Gary Kelly? He pulled off, and that's when Guy Butters equalised, and I smashed my leg on the chair celebrating and lost the minibus keys and in Leeds of all places. But that was an interesting day out, our goalkeeper was making his first or second appearance for us, turning up in front of the Leeds cop in a pink shirt. I mean, brave fella.
We enjoyed that. I think we had a right laugh at that, didn't we?
We did, yeah. Just going on to Guy Butters quickly, and a lot of people wouldn't have known this, but when Guy Butters come, he was large. He was big, and he wasn't fit, and Mark, again, done that sort of psychology thing. His man management was absolutely brilliant. He got into players' heads. And the fact that me and you had put on a bit of timber in the first couple of months, having a light ale here and there, he said to Butch, we get him in. We'd get him in early, 8 o'clock. And we was in the gym every morning, 8 o'clock. And we was doing like a fat-burning thing, weren't we? And Mark sort of did this, he set up this training regime. And Butch would come in and be the three of us on these treadmills, 8 o'clock in the morning, and we were fat-burning. And he thanked you so much for that, because he said he could, if he'd have met you earlier, he'd had a few more years in the game. Mm. But little things like that, sort of taking a player aside, is man management. I'm a great believer in that. It's not always about coaching. A lot of it, it's about man management. And you probably know Alex Ferguson. He doesn't stand on the side of the pitch, and we was talking about it earlier. I said, what do you do? Do you take any training sessions? Nah. When you're away with Scotland. Who does that? Well, we've got a coach. He's great. Me and Gordon might do a bit of pattern of play leading up to the game, but these days you let the coach in. I mean, how many staff did you say you got to Scotland now?
Yeah, I think we go away about 24 or something like that.
24. We used to have 4.
And we'll get into Cardiff in a minute, but these lovely things you're saying about Mark and, all the things that he did for the various players. You slept with Mark, didn't you?
It's the manager assistant thing. I've slept with a few managers. It happens.
Do you want to put some meat on that bone, as it were?
Sorry, Maria.
He's apologising, Nick. Maria.
Sorry, Nick, yeah. It's just, like I say, being an assistant manager is like almost being married to a man. You need to be touch tight to him. He needs to trust you. You need to be there for him. You need to pick him up when he needs picking up. You need to... It's a bit like... I shouldn't say a woman looking after her husband, but you just got... Do everything for them as much as you can, whether it's the coaching or the organisation. And that was my role, We didn't have staff. I used to book the coach. I'd book the hotels. I'd decide what we're eating. I'd decide how many people are travelling. I'd decide who we're picking up. And he would just sit on the front of the coach, fall asleep. But at the end of it, all you want him to worry about is picking the team. And Mark, as he said in quite a lot of his stuff here, it was a wee, because he would involve you. What do you think, big man? Should we be doing this and should we be doing that? So it's not all about the manager making decisions. He needs to bounce off of someone. So it's a bit similar to all the managers, that they bounced off of me and give something back.
Didn't quite answer my question, though.
No, I think he was getting there. No, it was a night with Mickey Adams. We'd gone up. I can't remember what the game was. It might have been Plymouth away when we got promoted the first time. Was it Plymouth away? And we was waiting for the rest of the results to come in, and they was waiting down the tunnel with all the banners, promoted and all that. And it was my first promotion as a staff member, to be fair, so I was quite excited. Anyway, we went up and we sort of got back and had a few beers, and then I'd always end up, I was living in Watford at the time, but I was more or less living out of Mickey Adams' house, to be fair, and his bed. And we got back, and we always used to go back to Mick's house in the conservatory and just sort of sit there and chew the cud and talk about the games and what had happened. And I think we got promoted with sort of 6 games to go, so he said, it's over to you now, you just carry on with the training. And we parted quite hard that then next couple of weeks. Anyway, the story was we finished drinking, and at the time his wife Claire, she just had the little baby Mitchell.
She breastfed you, didn't she?
Sort of, yeah. We Not quite. But we did have a good drink, and we ran out of beer and we ran out of wine, and he said there's some more drink back out in the conservatory in the utility room. So I went back out there, and it was more or less empty. Claire had gone to bed, Littleham was in bed, me and Mickey was with the CDs on, and I found one of these, you know, these old kegs that you just like IPA, whatever it is, that warm
Party
beer
stuff. 7 or something.
Yeah, so I found one of them. He said, well, that's all we got, we'll have it. I said, but it's warm, Gaffer. So he said, well, get some ice out the freezer, out the fridge. So no problem. So I found some ice and put a load of ice in it and went back into the room, and it's all frothing over. And, you know, he said, just get it down. At least it's cold, at least it's cold. So we necked it all, done it, went to bed, obviously together. And I was in bed with him, and we woke up in the morning with a bit of a thick head, and Claire came in with the newspapers, and we sort of sat up and, you know, like that. And she had a bit of a look on her face and said, what's happening? I said, what do you mean? She said, where's all the ice gone? We said, well, we had it in the beer, from the freezer. And she looked at us, she said, that was my breast milk frozen. and I looked at Mick, and he looked at me, and I wet my lips, and he said, that's the closest you're going to get to her breast. And we had drunk her breast milk. And that's a true story. And we didn't get the newspapers.
I just have got this image of you, like, squeezing each other's grapefruits and stuff. It's terrible.
No. Should we talk about Cardiff?
No, well, let's move on. We've got to get there first. Oh. One of the main problems we had that season was with goalkeepers and with strikers. There was a lot of goalkeepers we used. We used Michel Kuipers, Ben Roberts, Ross Blitney, Stuart Jones and John Keeley. Also, up front, you were looking for someone to play alongside Leon constantly. The first one to come in was Trevor Benjamin, and he went back to Leicester and was followed by Chris Owolumo.
Yeah, and Chris worked. I always felt that he didn't get as many goals as I hoped he'd get, but, you know, he made a contribution. He famously, of course, was brought down for the penalty at Cardiff, which was the major contribution that he made.
About his first game, because we struggled to get him signed, didn't we? Do you remember the fact?
Yeah, that's right. Was it Colchester or somewhere, wasn't it?
Chesterfield. Did he score a screamer?
Anyway, he scored a screamer.
Yeah, another chess story. Yeah, so anyway, we got him signed. I think he scored, didn't he?
Yeah, he scored a screamer.
He was a good influence, and he had a good effect on the team, although, as I say, I probably didn't re-sign him because I felt as if he should have got more goals.
But, I mean, he obviously went on to have a fantastic career elsewhere. He went to Germany like yourself. Okay, but we were gathering momentum, and there was a very important game. I mean, you talked about psychological stuff, and there was a 0-0 draw at Bristol City again, which you felt was, like, very, very important, especially going into the playoff final.
Yeah, psychologically, we had come some way from, you know, the gubbin we got in that first home game. I think we had progressed, we had got better, and I think that given that we eventually played Bristol City in the final, I think psychologically it was good for me to be able to, you know, talk about that game and talk about the fact that, you know, we had made that improvement. So, yeah, that was a significant factor in me having an argument as to how they could beat Bristol City in the final.
Well, we did get into the playoffs, and the first leg was a hot, hot day in Swindon, where Ben Roberts' goal led to charm life, Bob.
Ben Roberts?
Yeah, did that.
Oh, he did.
Yeah.
He was magnificent, wasn't he? Absolutely magnificent. We had a great following behind the goal there, didn't we, at times?
Yeah, we all dressed as John Prescott mask.
I think we, as far as the game was concerned, I think we were lucky. I think we got out alive, as it were. We won a game that maybe we didn't deserve to win, but we came back, obviously, to a team with high hopes.
And the weather was completely different.
And the pitch.
Yeah.
I've got wet, wet, wet written down here.
Yeah. I mean, some of the most important games I played in my career were played in rain because I played in Scotland. But and even, someone mentioned the fact that I played in a European final with Alex Ferguson's team. That was the wettest night I think I've ever played in.
Gothenburg, wasn't it?
In Gothenburg. Yeah, against Real Madrid. And it was absolutely horrendous. So, you know, that I had no fear of that. That was, you know, footballers don't let that affect them.
We had 12 years of getting wet with Dean, believe me. You just had three, sorry. But
it was a game which looks like Swindon clawed themselves back into it until a certain Adam Virgo pops up. It still dines out on it.
Yeah, but every bit of it's true. You know, I was kind of looking forward in the pitch at the situation with the seconds taken away, and I kind of glanced and Adam was standing in the halfway line. You know, and I shouted, you know, go, and he sort of, you know, we remember it, you know, he started to kind of, you know, go, and he sort of started jogging, you know. And I think if he'd went any faster, he wouldn't have scored. And if he'd went any slower, he wouldn't have scored. So the sort of gradual build-up of urgency that he seemed to come over him in terms of suddenly realise he had to get there quickly in the end. And the timing was absolutely perfect, and we always remember it, you know, the ball came in and he put it in the back of the net, you know. So it was just one of those strange moments. In a similar vein, when we had the game in Lithuania on Friday night, they left three up the park for the first corner, which we didn't expect. And when you leave three up the park, one of the ways you can combat that is if you put two out for the corner, then it gives them a problem because they then either have to come back or they leave themselves short. So Gordon was on his touchline screaming, go short, go short, go short. And Lee Griffiths took it long and we scored, you know. So like that, you know, sometimes you make the right call, sometimes you make the wrong call, well, of course.
Virgs himself will always tell the story that when he sort of like trotted forward and timed it well, what he'll always say is that he never saw the ball hit the back of the net because he threw himself at it with his eyes closed, fully expecting to be clattered by the keeper. The keeper never came out at all, but he was absolutely terrified and he just decided to throw himself at it and never saw the ball go into the net at all. So
Charlie Oatway's still taking the credit for it.
Yeah, I know he is, actually, isn't he? Yeah.
OK, well, that led to penalties, and you did do an awful lot of research on penalties beforehand and a lot of work on it, and although Adam Virg nearly tried to put it into the railway line.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I'd heard a lot of people in my career previous talking about how you can't prepare for a penalty shootout, and I just thought that was the biggest load of nonsense you've ever heard. You can prepare. You prepare by allowing the players to rehearse it, to understand if they are asked to take a penalty, exactly how they're going to take it. And the way we did it, Bob and I was, and Dean White, was that we broke it down. So we said to them, right, take a penalty. They took one. We said, take another one. And then we made comparisons between the two that they'd taken. So, for instance, they might have taken the first one, placed the ball, walked back to the 18-yard line, taken the penalty. The next one, they placed the ball, walked back maybe halfway to the 18-yard line and took the penalty. So then we made them decide, look, are you walking to the 18-yard line or are you walking halfway? Because we want you to know. So we absolutely broke it down and we said, so if you're taking a penalty, you're going to walk to the 18-yard line, you're going to move to the left, you're going to take it with your right foot, you're going to put it in the right-hand side. That's exactly what you're going to do. And as far as I was concerned, that was a device that took you out of the pressure, that allowed you to not think about the crowd and not think about the consequences because you were only thinking about the actual procedure of you taking the penalty kick. And that was the way we rehearsed it. So every single player in the squad knew that if they were going to step up, they knew exactly how they were going to take it.
I wonder if Danny Wilson told Tommy Mooney just to whack it against the bar then, in the same way.
Well, you know, you can rehearse the way we did and you can still whack it against the bar. Mm. Yeah. You know, the players have still got to execute it and there is pressure, of course there is, but, you know, we did it well.
Mm. OK, well, get to Cardiff we did, but for a lot of us, it was very tricky trying to get there because of the queues for the tickets. Now, there was how important in the fight for Falmouth, do you think that we did sell out our allocation of over 30,000 tickets for that game? And there was queues going down North Road around with Dean. Bob?
Well, we knew, you always knew that the fan base was there. And to get ourselves in a position there where they were going to turn up and buy tickets, you can never plan for that. You know, like you say, it was phenomenal the turnout. And a fantastic day. And the sea of blue and white was absolutely fantastic. I mean, I've got a lot of great memories about Cardiff, especially because we went up early, didn't we?
Two days before.
But even in that build-up, I remember, you know, when the queues were down at Withy, we were all down there. We went down to see the supporters and walk along the queues and see the guys that were waiting, you know, for all those hours for their tickets, you know, because we all were feeling it, you know, we were feeling the excitement and feeling part of it. And, of course, the numbers, I don't know what the club itself expected, but the numbers were absolutely outstanding.
Well, it was our first big day, our first big, big day on the national.
Since 1991.
Arguing since 91, possibly even more before that. I mean, because, you know, in 91 you'd have had, yes, there was interest in the playoff final, but obviously with the way that TV sort of expanded and grown even more so, I'd have actually probably put it up there with national coverage, the size and scale of the cup final. And it was our first big day since, it was certainly our first big day since the war years, 7 years beforehand. And it was, I think it was almost a day of celebration, come, you know, win or lose. Obviously, we wanted to win. We weren't necessarily expecting to do so because Bristol City were arguably the, you know, the stronger side. But it was actually a day of, I felt, it was a day of celebration. And I think that also, as much as we wanted to go up, there was also the perfect opportunity to show and tell John Prescott, look, this number of people want our stadium. Can you please listen to the people and all the banners that were there? So, I mean, it was big for the fans in probably more ways than one. It was obviously massive for the players. Everyone wants promotion. But for us, it was, you know, big on so many different levels. Yeah. And I think a key part of the long story and the long campaign that we had to eventually get the stadium.
Yeah. Now, Mark, the other thing you did have problems with when you went up there 2 days early was the wine list, apparently.
we did have, on a Friday night, once we had finished, we'd done the work that we had to do and made sure everyone was packed away, the staff would sit down and have a glass of wine. And, of course, on a Monday morning, Derek Allen would sigh, you know, say, see, you had a glass of wine.
That's the best impersonation you do, isn't it?
It's the only one.
Well, I do it others, but it sounds the same. But Derek Allen would be a bit, you know, dismayed, you know, the wine bill would come in. So before we went to Cardiff, he said to me, he said, what are you going to do about the wine? Because the reason being, we were going to be there for two nights. So that was Derek's great fear. So to help him, I said, well, I'll tell you what we'll do, Derek. I said, what was it, Friday and Saturday? The game was on Sunday, was that right? Yeah. So on a Friday and Saturday, I said to him, so Derek, what we'll do is on a Friday night, we'll only drink white wine, and on a Saturday night, we'll only drink red wine. Which is exactly what we've done.
Certainly, yeah.
Well, I mean, made it simple for him.
The players were having a good time up there, and Dan Harding got locked out of his room, I believe.
Yeah, I think it might have been Charlie and Chippy, because obviously players sort of roomed up quite, you know, on a regular sort of basis, and in Charlie's wisdom, he decided to put Dan Harding out on the balcony. I think he was out there for about 2 hours, wasn't he? Something like that.
Was he?
And obviously, if you don't come down for dinner at the right time, you get fined. So that was the next thing. So there was more money going in the coffers for the boys for the food trip that went in the season. So
good preparation for Whitehawk, I guess.
Good preparation. Well, you talk about preparation and some of the preparation for that, you just sort of said, though, you know, Bristol City were favourites. I think me and him, deep down, we knew we'd probably win it without being too arrogant and blasé about it. We just had a feeling that the players were up for it. You just got a feeling that they you know, they was on blob, they was training well, and we sort of kept it low-key, but really deep down I thought we could win this, you know, whether it was 1-0 or 2-0 or 3-0, but without being too arrogant, we really felt as if we had a win.
Did you have wind of thinking that maybe Bristol City weren't up for it, but kind of, you know, you had an edge, we're back to that word, psychological edge or something over them that, you know...
Well, the fans played a part as well, because I can remember coming down... We got in the coach, and obviously I used to sit at the front and direct the coach drive in case he didn't know where he was going. And we were coming down there, and the gaffer said, stop the coach and put this on. I didn't know what it was. And he'd done a couple of master strokes that day, and he gave me the CD, and some of you guys were all down there. The coach was going really slow. We were struggling to get into the ground. And he put on David Bowie, Heroes. Mm. And the back of my neck's up now thinking about it, because he was on that coach, and the sort of coach went quiet and the players listened to it, and it was just like magical. It was like, it wasn't coaching, it wasn't all this, it was just like a bit of music to psych the players up. And as you came into the gates, and I remember my family standing by the gates there, as you came in, you went down to the tunnel area and the coach disappeared, you know, it was a buzz, wasn't it? It was a buzz. And then, I mean, all the work had been done on the training pitch, sort of set plays and things like that, and then I used to put all the sheets up for the set plays, and, you know, the gaffer said, well, take them out for a warm-up, and I thought, well, he's not really had a chat with the players, and slightly different, still hadn't told me anything. And then we came in, and the lads are all expecting the team talk, and the gaffer, in his wisdom, he said, can you get me that flip chart around the corner? So I went to get a flip chart, and he said, turn the first page over. So I turned it over, and it was all, no disrespect, the lesser clubs, where you could be next year, you're going to be playing if you don't win today. And then he turned over the next sheet and it was the Leeds United, the Birminghams, all the championship teams. And he said, where do you want to be? And that was his team talk. It wasn't all this, you know, about the pattern of play. That was already done. It was just like, hit them with it. And they saw them teams and then grounds that they could go and play at.
You can see the lights go on.
Sorry?
You could see the lights going on their heads.
Yeah. You know, that was something that, you know, that wasn't something I had thought about a week earlier. That was something I thought of, you know, when they were out getting warmed up and I was thinking, what else can I say? What, you know, what can I give them? Just something to go out the door with. And, you know, and it was just came to me, you know, so like Bob said, you know, I wrote up the names of the first division grounds, you know, and it was like Oldham and, you know, I can't even remember the name of the grounds, you know, but the actual names of the grounds. And then on the other side there was, you know, Walker Stadium and all the great stadiums of teams that were in the championship at that time, and it was just night and day, you know. And I remember Michelle saying to me afterwards, he thought that it was the most significant thought that we gave them, you know, in terms of the tactics or anything. He said it just kind of absolutely, as you say, a light went on, and thought, wow, this is worth playing for.
Well, another thing was, of course, the mind games you played with Leon before that game.
Yeah, well, you know, Leon had to be kept in his toes. Leon was never not going to play, but, you know, you had to get Leon in the right frame of mind. He was a complicated little character. You know, everyone has their ways. We've said already, I think Leon should have had a far more successful career than he did, but we got him right on that day. We got him with us. We got him on our side. We, you know, he was there as part of the team. You know, we had kind of got hold of him, and we did that in different ways, including him going there with the fear that actually, you know, we could leave him out. You know, when I go back to when I worked with Alec Ferguson, I remember I could have played 28 games in a row and scored 20 goals in those. See, when he named a team, you breathed a sigh of relief, because somehow he made you think that you might not be playing, or, you know, that you had to, you know, be thankful that you were playing. He was just brilliant at it, you know. So when he named that team, regardless how many games in a row I had played, I'd think, thank God, you know. And it was a bit like that with Leo, and I wanted him to, when I named the team, to think, I'm playing, and can I be grateful a wee bit? And I think that worked for him.
In your sort of long managerial career, how much did you take from your time working under Ferguson at Aberdeen? I mean, you know, you're with him for, whatever it was, 4, 5, 6 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, the manager for sort of 20 plus or whatever it is. And, you know, how much stays with you?
I think you're not conscious necessarily of what stayed with you. I think I like to think that that as a manager, I would be the sum of all the managers that I've worked under, but that Alec Ferguson would be hugely the most influence on me. So how that actually manifests itself is quite difficult for me to say, because there are things that Alec Ferguson did that I would think, actually, I'd never do that, you know. And there's other things, of course, that you consciously think, like the sort of psychology side of it, the thing with Dan Harding and the boys when I first arrived that morning, with Leon Knight, the threat of not playing. Those are Alec Ferguson things. But there's a lot of other things from other managers that you just become, rather than actually consciously thinking, oh, because Davy Hay or Billy McNeil or Ernst Happel and Günter Netzer or whoever the guys I've worked under, Jim Smith, you know, you don't consciously think that as a manager. You just, you be yourself, you be your own manager, but you are the sum of all those influences.
Sorry, I've got to say this. I didn't realise you actually worked under Ernst Happel. Sorry, I'm going to stand like a football nerd here. I mean, obviously, well, I assume this was at Hamburg. I mean, Ernst Happel is a sort of a legend across European, was Austrian, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, was he, yeah. I mean, they've got the National Stadium in Austria is named after him, I think,
absolutely,
isn't he? So that must have been a chilling thing to have.
Günter Netzer was no slouch either.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I mean, I was very fortunate to work under guys like that. Huge influence on me. Ernst Happel was getting older at the time. Unfortunately, Ernst Happel was, you know, he was an alcoholic, but he was also a genius, you know.
Yeah.
He was brilliant, and he was just a football guy. And, you know, it was brilliant to work under, and as you say, a name in Europe. The National Stadium of Vienna is the Ernst Happel Stadium. An honour to have worked under him.
OK. What did winning the playoff final mean to you, Bob?
I've got a very treasured picture in my study where I'm just standing on the pitch. I think it's in the book, actually. Just get that in again.
Have you got a book out?
And it's just standing. The celebrations were going on, and I just remember just sort of reaching to the sky and looking up and just thinking, yeah, this is what it's all about. You know, it was a fantastic day, and one that will live with me like for a long, long time. The game, the celebrations afterwards. I remember the gaffer coming to me on the quiet and remember he's a Scotsman. He slipped me 500 quid and said, go and get as much booze as you can for the coach. Get all the girlfriends and get the wives. I had a wife and a girlfriend. and bring them all back on the coach and, we'll party on down. And that's what we did, didn't we? I mean, 500 quid and me and Matt Hicks, the kit man, we went down the local off licence in our club tracksuits and we loaded it right up. And it was fantastic coming back on the coach. I think we come back to Withdean, didn't we? And we went into the sport. Is it the sport?
Sportsman, yeah.
Yeah. On the way, the players. Do you remember when they opened the skylight?
Yeah.
And the skylights that you open on a coach and it flew off. I mean, if
was that Leon Knight did that?
He should have gone out of it. If anyone would have been behind us, it would have killed them. So you can imagine like the fresh air coming through the coach for about another 300 miles, but it didn't matter by that time. So it all came to a head, and it was a good celebration, great day.
It can't have been that great if you remembered it.
Well, yeah, I do remember. I'm not going to go into too much detail about that at the moment, and the wife's here as well.
So Mark, same question.
She was involved.
Same question to you. What did winning the playoffs mean to you?
Well, I think that, I had come from Millwall, where we had been promoted from that division directly to the Championship. We'd been beating the Championship playoffs. I'd kind of got used to kind of being at that level, being the Championship level. So, to get back to that level, and for the exact same reason as that list that we showed the players, was equally attractive to myself, to be going and playing against these sort of teams. So from that point of view, it was just, it was a great thing to look forward to. But on the day, as Bob said, I have very fortunate that, I played for teams who have won cups, I've won the Scottish Cup 5 times, I've scored against England.
and I saw it again today. He got the golden boot.
Yeah,
he got a bad
but,
one.
All of those things, and I'm very, very fortunate to have experienced all of that in football. But that day is up there with any of them. It really was. I'm not being sick of panty. It was a brilliant, brilliant. It wasn't a fantastic game, but we won the game tactically, and that was satisfying. And the remember the heat that day and the atmosphere and the fans. Remember me sending Michelle down to get the fans going, and the way it all was just absolutely brilliant.
We told Kermau to, but he went down the other end.
Yeah. But it was a fantastic day. It was I think part of it is Cardiff itself, the place. The stadium for the playoff finals was a magnificent venue for playoff finals, and on that day it was at its best with the Bristol City crowd the way they were, and of course you guys the way you were.
Okay, well that's it. That's all we've got time for this half. So thank you, of course, to Mark McGee. Thank you to Bob Booker. To Alan Wares. I'm Ailey Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course, in front of these beautiful people here at the Camellia. We'll see you for the second half shortly. Thanks a lot. Yeah.